This text was prepared by David Price, CCX074, Coventry. AAC. UCC. From the 1921 J. M. Dent edition. Notes on Life and Letters by Joseph Conrad. Contents. Author's Note Part I Letters Books 1905. Henry James and Appreciation 1905 Elephants Dotted 1898 Guy de Maupassant 1904 Anatole France 1904 Turgenev 1917 Stephen Crane A Note Without Dates 1919 Tales of the Sea 1898 An Observer in Malaya 1898 A Happy Wanderer 1910 The Life Beyond 1910 The Ascending Effort 1910 The Censor of Plays and Appreciation 1907 Part 2 Life, Autocracy and War 1905 The Crime of Partition 1919 A Note on the Polish Problem 1916 Poland Revisited 1915 First News 1918 Well Done 1918 Tradition 1918 Confidence 1919 Flight 1917 Some Reflections on the Loss of the Titanic 1912 Certain Aspects of the Admirable Inquiry into the Loss of the Titanic 1912 Protection of Ocean Liners 1914 A Friendly Place. Author's Note. I don't know whether I ought to offer an apology for this collection which has more to do with life than with letters. Its appeal is made to orderly minds. This, to be frank about it, is a process of tidying up, which, from the nature of things, cannot be regarded as premature. The fact is that I wanted to do it myself, because of a feeling that had nothing to do with the considerations of worthiness or unworthiness of the small but unbroken pieces collected within the covers of this volume. Of course it may be said that I might have taken up a broom and used it without saying anything about it. That, certainly, is one way of tidying up. But it would have been too much to have expected me to treat all this matter as removable rubbish. All those things had a place in my life. Whether any of them deserve to have been picked up and ranged on the shelf, this shelf I cannot say, and, frankly, I have not allowed my mind to dwell on the question. I was afraid of thinking myself into a mood that would hurt my feelings. For those pieces of writing, whatever may be the comment on their display, appertain to the character of the man. And so here they are, dusted, which was but a decent thing to do, but in no way polished, extending from the year 98 to the year 20 a thin array, for such a stretch of time, of really innocent attitudes. Conrad Literary, Conrad Political, Conrad Reminiscent, Conrad Controversial. Well, yes. A one-man show, or is it merely the show of one man? The only thing that will not be found amongst those figures and things that have passed away will be Conrad N. Pantoufles. It is a constitutional inability. Schlafrock und Pantoffeln. Not that. Never. I don't know whether I dare boast like a certain South American general who used to say that no emergency of war or peace had ever found him with his boots off. But I may say that, whenever the various periodicals mentioned in this book called on me to come out and blow the trumpet of personal opinions or strike the pensive lute that speaks of the past, I always tried to pull on my boots first. I didn't want to do it, God knows. Their editors, to whom I beg to offer my thanks here, made me perform mainly by kindness, but partly by bribery. Well, yes. Bribery? What can you expect? I never pretended to be better than the people in the next street, or even in the same street. This volume, including these embarrassed introductory remarks, is as near as I shall ever come to deshabille in public, and perhaps it will do something to help towards a better vision of the man, if it gives no more than a partial view of a piece of his back, a little moldy after the process of tidying up, a little bowed, and receding from the world, not because of weariness or misanthropy, but for other reasons that cannot be helped. Because the leaves fall, the water flows, the clock ticks with that horrid pitiless solemnity which you must have observed in the ticking of the hall clock at home. For reasons like that. Yes. in receipts, and this was the chance to afford one more view of it even to my own eyes. The section within this volume called Letters explains itself, though I do not pretend to say that it justifies its own existence. It claims nothing in its defense except the right of speech, which I believe belongs to everybody outside a Trappist monastery. The part I have ventured, for shortness's sake, to call life, may perhaps justify itself by the emotional sincerity of the feelings to which the various papers included under that head owe their origin. And as they relate to events, of which everyone has a date, they are in the nature of signposts pointing out the direction my thoughts were compelled to take at the various crossroads. If anybody detects any sort of consistency in the choice, this will be only proof positive that wisdom had nothing to do with it. Whether right or wrong, instinct alone is invariable, a fact which only adds a deeper shade to its inherent mystery. The appearance of intellectuality these pieces may present at first sight is merely the result of the arrangement of words. The logic that may be found there is only the logic of the language. But I need not labor the point. There will be plenty of people sagacious enough to perceive the absence of all wisdom from these pages. But I believe sufficiently in human sympathies to imagine that very few will question their sincerity. Whatever delusions I may have suffered from, I have had no delusions as to the nature of the facts commented on here. I may have misjudged their import. But that is the sort of error for which one may expect a certain amount of toleration. The only paper of this collection which has never been published before is the Note on the Polish Problem. It was written at the request of a friend to be shown privately, and its protectorate idea, sprung from a strong sense of the critical nature of the situation, was shaped by the actual circumstances of the time. The time was about a month before the entrance of Romania into the war, and though, honestly, I had seen already the shadow of coming events, I could not permit my misgivings to enter into and destroy the structure of my plan. I still believe that there was some sense in it. It may certainly be charged with the appearance of lack of faith, and it lays itself open to the throwing of many stones. But my object was practical, and I had to consider warily the preconceived notions of the people to whom it was implicitly addressed, and also their unjustifiable hopes. They were unjustifiable, but who was to tell them that? I mean, who was wise enough and convincing enough to show them the inanity of their mental attitude? The whole atmosphere was poisoned with visions that were not so much false as simply impossible. They were also the result of vague and unconfessed fears, and that made their strength. For myself, with a very definite dread in my heart, I was careful not to allude to their character, because I did not want the note to be thrown away unread. And then I had to remember that the impossible has sometimes the trick of coming to pass to the confusion of minds, and often to the crushing of hearts. Of the other papers I have nothing special to say. They are what they are, and I am by now too hardened a sinner to feel ashamed of insignificant indiscretions. And as to their appearance in this form, I claim that indulgence to which all sinners against themselves are entitled. J.C. 1920. Part I Letters. Books 1905. I have not read this author's books, and if I have read them, I have forgotten what they were about. These words are reported as having been uttered in our midst not 100 years ago, publicly, from the seat of justice, by a civic magistrate. The words of our municipal rulers have a solemnity and importance far above the words of other mortals, because our municipal rulers, more than any other variety of our governors and masters, represent the average wisdom, temperament, sense and virtue of the community. This generalization, it ought to be promptly said in the interests of eternal justice and recent friendship, does not apply to the United States of America. There, if one may believe the long and helpless indignations of their daily and weekly press, the majority of municipal rulers appear to be thieves of a particularly irrepressible sort. But this, by the way, My concern is with a statement issuing from the average temperament and the average wisdom of a great and wealthy community, and uttered by a civic magistrate obviously without fear and without reproach. I confess I am pleased with his temper, which is that of prudence. I have not read the books, he says, and immediately he adds, and if I have read them I have forgotten. This is excellent caution. And I like his style. It is unartificial, and bears the stamp of manly sincerity. As a reported piece of prose, this declaration is easy to read, and not difficult to believe. Many books have not been read, still more have been forgotten. As a piece of civic oratory, this declaration is strikingly effective. Calculated to fall in with the bent of the popular mind, so familiar with all forms of forgetfulness, it has also the power to stir up a subtle emotion while it starts a train of thought, and what greater force can be expected from human speech? But it is in naturalness that this declaration is perfectly delightful, for there is nothing more natural than for a grave city father to forget what the books he has read once long ago in his giddy youth maybe were about. And the books in question are novels, or, at any rate, were written as novels. I proceed thus cautiously, following my illustrious example, because being without fear and desiring to remain as far as possible without reproach, I confess at once that I have not read them. I have not, and of the million persons or more who are said to have read them, I never met one yet with the talent of lucid exposition sufficiently developed to give me a connected account of what they are about. But they are books, part and parcel of humanity, and as such, in their ever-increasing, jostling multitude, they are worthy of regard, admiration, and compassion. Especially of compassion. It has been said a long time ago that books have their fate. They have, and it is very much like the destiny of man. They share with us the great incertitude of ignominy or glory of severe justice, and senseless persecution of calumny and misunderstanding the shame of undeserved success. Of all the inanimate objects, of all men's creations, books are the nearest to us, for they contain our very thought, our ambitions, our indignations, our illusions, our fidelity to truth, and our persistent leaning towards error. But most of all, they resemble us in their precarious hold on life. A bridge constructed according to the rules of the art of bridge building is certain of a long, honorable, and useful career. But a book as good in its way as the bridge may perish obscurely on the very day of its birth. The art of their creators is not sufficient to give them more than a moment of life. Of the books born from the restlessness, the inspiration, and the vanity of human minds, those that the muses would love best lie more than all others under the menace of an early death. Sometimes their defects will save them. Sometimes a book fair to see may, to use a lofty expression, have no individual soul. Obviously a book of that sort cannot die. It can only crumble into dust. But the best of books, drawing sustenance from the sympathy and memory of men, have lived on the brink of destruction, for men's memories are short, and their sympathy is, we must admit, a very fluctuating, unprincipled emotion. No secret of eternal life for our books can be found amongst the formulas of art, any more than for our bodies in a prescribed combination of drugs. This is not because some books are not worthy of enduring life, but because the formulas of art are dependent on things variable, unstable, and untrustworthy, on human sympathies, on prejudices, on likes and dislikes, on the sense of virtue and the sense of propriety, on beliefs and theories that, indestructible in themselves, always change their form often in the lifetime of one fleeting generation. 2. Of all books, novels, which the muses should love, make a serious claim on our compassion. The art of the novelist is simple. At the same time, it is the most elusive of all creative arts, the most liable to be obscured by the scruples of its servants and votaries, the one preeminently destined to bring trouble to the mind and the heart of the artist. After all, the creation of a world is not a small undertaking except perhaps to the divinely gifted. In truth, every novelist must begin by creating for himself a world, great or little, in which he can honestly believe. This world cannot be made otherwise than in his own image. It is fated to remain individual, and a little mysterious, and yet it must resemble something already familiar to the experience, the thoughts and the sensations of his readers. At the heart of fiction, even the least worthy of the name, some sort of truth can be found, if only the truth of a childish theatrical ardor in the game of life, as in the novels of Dumas the Father. But the fair truth of human delicacy can be found in Mr. Henry James' novels, and the comical, appalling truth of human rapacity let loose amongst the spoils of existence lives in the monstrous world created by Balzac. The pursuit of happiness by means lawful and unlawful, through resignation or revolt, by the clever manipulation of conventions, or by solemn hanging onto the skirts of the latest scientific theory, is the only theme that can be legitimately developed by the novelist who is the chronicler of the adventures of mankind amongst Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.